Ladies and gentlemen, our first case for this morning is Amerisure Insurance Company against Scottsdale Insurance Company, 11-2762 and 2771. Mr. Peters.
May it please the Court. I'm Stephen Peters. I am counsel for plaintiff, counter-defendant, and appellant, Amerisure Insurance Company. This is a consolidated appeal from the Southern District of Indiana, sitting in diversity jurisdiction, applying Indiana law. The action is an insurance coverage dispute involving the duty to indemnify as to the proper allocation between insurers as to the funding of a settlement agreement of a bodily injury claim arising from a construction accident. The standard of review here is de novo as to the district court's cross summary judgment rulings and questions of law as to the contractual issues. I hope to talk, in the time permitted, about two issues. First, the district court's summary judgment ruling as to the cross-liability exclusion and the Scottsdale umbrella policy must be reversed because the district court impermissibly rewrote the exclusion contrary to Indiana law. Second, this court should reverse and remand this action with instructions to grant summary judgment to Amerisure and National Surety and deny summary judgment as to Scottsdale. As to the first issue, the focus is upon the cross-liability exclusion, which in relevant part states that coverage is excluded under the Scottsdale umbrella policy for bodily injury arising out of a claim or suit brought by any insured against another insured. Importantly,
but let me say that the district court read this in a fairly sensible way. If what we're supposed to imagine is that, in your view, such a suit arises out of a claim or suit brought by an insured against another insured only if, you know, somebody has a car accident on the way to the courthouse or something. I mean, it was such a strained meaning that you were trying to put on it. Seems to me a district in Indiana, as in other states, contracts are read with common sense.
Again, under applicable Indiana law, each one of these provisions are subject to established rules of construction. And again,
sure, and I'm looking at the cross-liability exclusion. This insurance, as you just said, doesn't apply to bodily injury, property damage, or personal or advertising injury arising out of a claim or suit brought by any insured against another insured. So we have the last part of that. We have Mr. Kolip, who was insured because he was an employee, and we have ISF, who's specifically named as another insured entity under that policy.
Correct.
So it's just the arising out of part that you're...
That's the rub, Your Honor, under Indiana law, because Indiana law has a unique causation rule as to the phrase arising out of.
Well, I don't know about that. I mean, it seems to me Indiana equally says don't read things absurdly. I mean, I can't even imagine what would be a claim arising out of a claim.
Well, what would be a bodily injury arising out of a claim or a lawsuit? I agree with you, Your Honor.
It can't be nothing, because then that would violate a different rule of contract construction.
Well, there are some things here, but again, remember, I'm not here to be an apologist or a defender of this exclusion. It's within Scottsdale's power to draft exclusions to mean the adoption that has been articulated by Scottsdale and adopted by the district court. As we noted, actually was noted in National Surety's brief, there are a number of other policy provisions in the Scottsdale policy where they use language to accomplish the purpose. But here, what happened is Scottsdale chose the language that was put in the policy, and Indiana law is very explicit that when the policy provision is plain and unambiguous, you enforce it as it is stated.
Why do you find this plain and unambiguous? The district court described it as inartfully drafted, which I thought was a pretty good description.
Well, I'll agree that it's inartfully drafted, but there is a plain, ordinary meaning to the phrase bodily injury arising out of
a claim or suit?
Yes, Your Honor.
Well,
Because, again, Indiana law, and let me...
How does bodily injury arise out of a claim or suit? You get a paper cut?
Well, what you can do, you can have, for example, and examples were given in a national sureties brief, if there was, say, someone, there was an action for eviction, and someone goes out and they injure someone in the process of evicting or repossessing the car, there could be bodily injury arising out of a claim or suit. And that being the case, Indiana would deem that to be...
That's the prosecution of a claim or suit. I'm not sure it's the claim or suit itself that leads to that injury either, to tell you the truth.
Well, again, Indiana is not a big fan of exclusions. I mean, it will adopt them if they're reasonably drafted.
But Indiana, I don't think, also has this neutral stance policy when it's simply a business-to-business dispute like this one. You're not arguing contra profferentum or anything.
Well, no, but again, the Wright versus American States case has been cited for the proposition, and that was former Chief Judge Ratliff sitting as senior judge, and there was this discussion about the neutral stance. But again, what happened was Judge Ratliff said, "Well, I look at this; it's the meaning of this disputed phrase is understandable. Therefore, what I do is to adopt the plain and ordinary meaning of the words as used." But again, the rub here, Your Honor, is that this is a court sitting in diversity, and under Erie is obliged to follow the law of Indiana.
Well, you could have filed, I mean, this could have been all done by the Indiana courts, I assume.
It could have been, but there was an agreement to refile this in federal district court in the Southern District.
So you just are going to have to live with what the federal court thinks the policy means, I suppose.
But again,
obviously, we do try to follow Indiana law, but there are a number of provisions there.
I think the important point here is, and actually, again, the Indiana Lumberman's case, which is an Indiana Supreme Court case dating back to 1973, with respect to the phrase arising out of, has adopted the efficient and predominating cause test.
Right. I'm going to ask the other side about whether they agree that that test uses. I have a different question for you, actually, which is when in the course of this lawsuit did you actually first have access to the text of this policy, the Scottsdale policy?
It probably would have, my recollection would have been around the time that the declaratory judgment action was filed.
Okay, so you had an opportunity to read this umbrella policy at the time and presumably to spot for yourself this cross-liability exclusion.
Well, Your Honor, it's not our obligation to assert exclusion.
I didn't say it was your obligation, but I'm saying as a lawyer thinking about what your client might be facing, surely you read the policy.
The policies were there and available to be read, Your Honor.
Okay.
But then by the same token, I'm assuming Scottsdale was able to read the policy as well and could have timely asserted this as a specific affirmative defense had it chosen to do so, but it didn't.
Well, it just was giving these generic statements, which may or may not be enough. It's not that they ever said we're waiving this defense. They just didn't highlight it.
Going back to the arising out of test, the causation test, but one exception that I'm aware of, the efficient and predominating cause test has been used in interpreting and applying the causation test whenever the phrase arising out of use. The only probably question mark about that would be the Liberty Mutual versus Michigan Mutual case, and I know something about that because I was Michigan Mutual's counsel.
But, you know, why can't you just read this as to be bodily injury, property damage, or personal or advertising injury arising out of the content of a claim or suit?
Because, Your Honor, you're implying terms. Actually, what's happening is...
I mean, that's the whole question. Are we interpreting or are we simply adding to?
Case law is clear that the court cannot, under the guise of contract construction, enlarge or narrow the scope of the policy.
Well, I understand that as a glittering generality, but I'm not sure that one reads language to be absurd either.
Well, Your Honor, in order to reach the goal that you're talking about, you have to either put some words in this provision or you have to take some words out.
Don't I have to first find that it's ambiguous?
Well, Your Honor, I think, again, our contention is you look at it, the phrase bodily injury arising out of a suit or a claim is pretty plain and pretty clear.
Well, maybe it is to you. We'll see what the other side thinks.
There is one thing I would. I think it's. I don't know which reply brief it's in, page 4, where it's referring to this Grinnell case. It says bodily injuries arising out of connotes a causal connection between an insured's business activities and a victim's injuries. And it seems to me the victim, Mr. Collip, it's part of their insured's business activities that he was injured.
Well, again, the exclusion that's in play here is it arising out of the claim or lawsuit? And, of course, Mr. Collip's injuries cannot arise out of the claim or lawsuit because his injuries occurred first temporally. Yeah. And the claim and the suit arose secondarily.
How about the other way around? Didn't ISF's injuries arise out of Mr. Collip's lawsuit?
ISF's injuries. Well, the indemnity claim would arise out of that.
Well, that's the point. So, I mean, that's still an insured against another insured. So ISF's injuries arise out of Mr. Collip's lawsuit.
But that's not applicable, Your Honor, because the indemnity claim is neither a bodily injury, nor is it a property damage, nor is it advertising injury. So the exclusion does not apply.
Okay.
I would like to note for the court an important concession that was made by Scottsdale on page 23 and 24 of its appellee's brief, which they essentially concede that but for the existence of this exclusion, there is coverage for the settlement under the umbrella under the Scottsdale umbrella policy. So I would urge the court to take a look at that.
Well, that sort of implies they didn't know about it either.
Know about the exclusion?
Yeah. I'm just wondering about that. It seems that, you talk about the letter.
Well, the June 24th reservation rights letter. I mean, Judge Wood asked me questions. Didn't you have the policy? Didn't you read it? And, this could be something that happened. Well, that applies with equal vigor to Scottsdale because, frankly, the facts that were all available to assert this exclusion were well known to them, well known to Scottsdale by the time it filed its reservation of rights letter, if not before. So the question then becomes, if they were aware of this exclusion back then, why did they wait to at the close of discovery and on the eve of filing cross summary judgment motions to assert this? And not only assert this, but to do about a total change from their coverage position that had been maintained throughout the lawsuit. So that brings a second point about why the court must be reversed. And this is an alternative ground, and it's independent of the construction principles that we're articulating here, but that's the mend the whole doctrine.
Are you sure Indiana follows that? It seems it's very thin.
Well, again, we have cited the Harriman's case, which is the Seventh Circuit applying Indiana law, where the court recognized the mend the whole doctrine.
And as you just pointed out, the Seventh Circuit doesn't speak authoritatively about Indiana law. What Indiana cases? I looked, and there are very, very few.
There is, in fact, in the Harriman case, I recall, I forget the site, but in the Harriman case, there is a site to an older Indiana state court case.
1912 decision or whatever it was?
20s, I believe, Your Honor.
That really old one, yeah.
Some people would view that as vintage wine.
Well,
I thought it was fairly recent myself.
But the other aspect here, Your Honor, is mend the whole has two aspects. There's a procedural aspect, which would be this court's call about whether to apply it. But to the extent it is a substantive contractual principle, it becomes part of the law of Indiana. And therefore, under the diversity jurisdiction rules as set forth by Tompkins, the court would be constrained to apply and enforce mend the hold.
If Indiana follows it, Illinois, for example, certainly does have far more cases in that area. So if this were an Illinois case, I think we'd have something to talk about. It seems that Indiana has not embraced it often, if at all.
Yeah, but I cannot recall if the home case is the Indiana Supreme Court case. I believe it is. I might be mistaken about that, Your Honor. But, it would be our point that under the circumstances of this case, given the pre-suit coverage letters, given the allegations that were made by Scottsdale, basically disputing the amount of its contribution, not the existence of its coverage, and also the pre-trial statements of its coverage theories, which was a we were totally misled as to what, and we are entitled to rely upon that as litigants, and then at the 11th hour to have this raised, I think it invokes the amendment hold. But I see my time is up, so I would like to defer to Ms. Reed.
All right. Thank you very much. Ms. Reed?
Thank you. May it please the Court. My name is Laura Reed, and I represent National Surety Corporation. I'd like to begin by addressing some of the questions that the Court was asking about the cross-liability exclusion and when would it apply when you read it as it is written and apply its plain and ordinary terms. It would apply to the circumstances under which Mr. Peters referred. It would also apply, for example, if one insured, if there was a lease agreement that required the lessee to name the lessor or vice versa on a lease, and there is a claim that the lease is breached and the tenant is being evicted and the landlord goes in and throws out all the property and physically removes the person, causes bodily injury and property damage. That is bodily injury or property damage arising out of a claim for breach of contract. That's when this particular language would apply, as it is written and as the plain and ordinary language would apply. So it's not absurd to apply the term arising out of as requiring the claim or suit to occur at least before the bodily injury, property damage, or personal and advertising injury. If the Court finds that the exclusion by its language does not apply to the facts of this case, it doesn't need to delve into estoppel, mend the hold, and prejudice. But if it finds that the exclusion language could apply to this case, then it has to then go into the prejudice. And we showed in our briefs prejudice as a matter of law. And I see that my time is up.
No, you don't.
You have a minute, but if you want to save some rebuttal time.
Actually, I don't. We presented prejudice as a matter of law in our briefs, our consolidated reply brief at page 7 through 9, citing to the designated evidence. We also showed that same argument and evidence in our SIR reply, page 7 through 10, docket 160. So the evidence was presented. And the argument was made below. So Scottsdale's argument that we have somehow waived it because we didn't make it to the trial, to the district court, is not correct. And the evidence that establishes prejudice as a matter of law under Indiana law is that Scottsdale controlled the defense. It sent a letter raising it or asserting its coverage position and did not say that its umbrella policy did not cover this. And it
if you could just finish your thought, that would be great.
Okay. It controlled the defense for another 9 months. It sent 30 pages of letters with its coverage position, never once saying that its policy did not provide coverage. It's stopped as a matter of law, and prejudice as a matter of law was established. Thank you. We ask that the court reverse the district court and remand with directions to enter summary judgment. Thank you.
Thank you very much. So we'll next hear from Ms. Pocatera.
May it please the court. I'm Jan Pocatera from Salmon Brightman on behalf of Appalee Scottsdale Insurance Company. As this court is aware, this entire appeal focuses on one sentence. As the court is aware, this entire appeal focuses on one sentence. The sentence has already been discussed here.
And I guess I want to turn, I have two things I'd like you to address. First of all, the primary point that your opponents are making, that if you had wanted to have an exclusion, cross-liability exclusion for bodily injury arising out of injuries to any insured against another or liability or something like that, you could have written it. Instead, you wrote this rather odd language. And secondly, I'm concerned about the prejudice point because it seems to me, had the Amerisure the other parties known that you were going to invoke this exclusion, they might well have taken a different position in the settlement discussions. There's nothing magic about the number $2.9 million. It could have been $2.5 million, it could have been $3.5, it could have been anywhere else. They started higher, of course. But if you know you're on the line for more, you might take a tougher position. You might even say, fine, we're just not going to settle. Let's go to trial. So I'm worried about the prejudice issue as well as about the way one should deal with this claim or suit language.
Okay. Let's address first the arising out of. I believe that you had spoken with Mr. Peters on that issue. One of the things that the court did below was properly take this case into a neutral stance interpretation. And as I remember, the Wright case was actually put forward in front of your honors, and I would ask you to read the Wright case because it does say, with regard to the neutral stance, and I quote from the Wright case, that in order to be able to look at a case in the right way, one has to interpret, and it used the words interpret. It actually looked at the cross-liability exclusion, and it looked at the neutral stance in order to be able to utilize what the actual meaning was.
But that's now, what I thought I was doing. I mean, I don't care who drafted this. What it says, though, is bodily injury, et cetera, arising out of a claim or suit. So whether you drafted it, whether it was a standard form, whether they drafted it, it doesn't matter. We still need to understand what is bodily injury arising out of a claim or suit, not an underlying event.
Well, first as to the arising out of, as far as Indiana law.
Why can't we do it as the whole phrase?
Well, the
arising
whole phrase.
Arising out of what? Arising out of a claim or suit.
Arising out of basically means in conjunction with, connected to.
Well, and does it in Indiana? They say no. They
in
say
Indiana. The I'm sorry, Your Honor. In Indiana, please forgive me. The arising out of language for a proximate and efficient cause is almost virtually all in an auto liability policy. It is not addressed that way in a CGL context.
But you didn't cite any CGL where Indiana courts thought that arising out of just meant somehow or another related to.
There actually, in the CGL context, there was a case in Indiana basically saying that the arising out of did not mean an efficient proximate cause because that was actually relegated basically to the automobile context, and it refused to use that particular arising out of interpretation for a landlord-tenant. And it said that it actually meant more like what the treatises and other cases in other states mean, which is related to, in connection with, or arising out of. So what we mean by arising out of any claim or suit brought by any insured against another insured is that the bodily injury needs to be connected with the claim or suit. If it's connected with...
Just say connected with, then, or associated with, or something. Arising out of suggests a sequence, that there's first a claim or suit, and then something else happens.
Well, let me give you another example where I think arising out of wouldn't mean that. Say, for example, we were looking at the mend the hole doctrine. The Seventh Circuit actually looked at that doctrine several different times in Harbor Insurance, for example. And basically it said the mend the hole doctrine is arising out of an old term for wrestling. Now, if I said that, it would make sense to you in plain language.
So there's a sequence. First there was the old wrestling, and then there was the mend the hole metaphor, which eventually turns itself into a doctrine.
Bodily injury arising out of a claim or suit.
Right, so first there's the claim or suit, then there's the bodily injury. It's not a claim or suit arising out of bodily injury. It's bodily injury arising out of a claim or suit.
Basically, the right. idea is it
That's
is
how it's worded.
It is actually worded that way. Any claim or bodily injury arising out of any claim or suit brought by any
the other insurer. Way around, a claim or suit arising out of bodily injury, I'm sure we wouldn't even be here.
That may be the case, Your Honor. And while I can't speak to the actual drafters of this particular policy as far as their mindset at the time, I believe that this is the plain language. I believe that the district court got it right. It looked at the plain language. It looked at it in a neutral stance, and it tried to determine the general intent of Scottsdale's exclusion. It also looked at other cases, the Itnor case, which we cited to the court below. It basically had very, very similar language, and though it was not an Indiana case, nor was it an Illinois case.
That's this Florida thing, right?
Yes, that was the Florida case. However, as we pointed out in our appellate papers herein, there is a new and very good, very well-reasoned case entitled Archer Daniels. Versus IBM. In that particular case...
But, you know, why do we even care about cases? If this language is really so plain, then what difference does it make what a district court may have said about it or a Florida court? Shouldn't we all be able to sit there and read it and say we understand it?
Well, we should be able to read it, as Your Honor said, so that we don't read it out of existence. If you try to torture and twist this language, as appellants have done here, you end up virtually nullifying it out of the policy.
But, of course, they have the same argument that reading it your way nullifies the indemnity provision because the company ISF that's being indemnified in the vast majority of the cases where it's hoping for indemnification has just gotten something illusory.
It isn't illusory, and let me give you several examples that I think we've provided in our pleadings. If there were not an insured as a plaintiff, for example, Mr. Kolop was an insured employee, had it been another vendor on that site, had it been a governmental inspector on that site that sued ISF, had it been a pizza man that was on the site and tripped on something, had it been any other contractor's employee that sued ISF, and I would submit to Your Honors, that's the vast majority of coverage.
But why would Central have had anything to do with all of those other situations? It's the Central link. ISF has its own insurance, obviously. Here you are. But it's the Central link that I think implicates the Central employees most of the time.
The idea that I was proposing is that Central drops a piece of steel on the site. It lands on the sidewalk and somebody trips on it. The government inspector actually trips over some equipment that Central had on the site. It could still arise out of Central's liability. And then it would be covered because it wouldn't be any insured against another insured. It would be a third party against ISF. That would be covered under the indemnity agreement, under the insured contract, under the contractual liability endorsement.
Let me ask you a general question. Does anybody ever sell indemnity insurance that would fill this gap?
Actually, interestingly enough, if you look into the national surety policy, and the other insurance clause in the national insurance policy makes very clear that at the insured's option, it would drop down and be something other than umbrella coverage at the insured option.
So if they had looked at your policy and they said, we don't want you to have this cross-liability exclusion, and you went back and repriced it and came back and said, all right, you know, well, without that exclusion, here's the new price.
Well,
that's possible?
It would not be possible for Scottsdale. In fact, we had submitted with our underlying pleadings testimony, their declaration from Penny Pennick, who was the underwriter for the Scottsdale policy, for this Scottsdale policy that
we're talking about. I'm asking a different question, maybe.
It was the corporate policy not to allow umbrella coverage or excess coverage to drop down to primary non-contributory coverage.
But
Scottsdale
but
would not
the,
do
does
that.
Does Scottsdale have a policy that they would never write an indemnity provision that would cover this kind of situation?
Scottsdale's,
I mean, for a price, obviously. I'm not saying this policy, because this policy was priced out with the exclusion, but for a price, they just never sell it. Because if they don't sell it, no one else sells it, then my problem with being illusory comes back.
I actually would not be able to tell you at this time, or particularly back in 2005, 2006. I can't tell you what Scottsdale's policy was as far as the whether for a price they would change their language to a manuscript. I don't know that. I do know that as a general policy, and Ms. Pinnock stated, it was a corporate policy, that their umbrella liability policies, which provide indemnity for bodily injury, would not be allowed to drop down to a primary non-contributory position. It was against Scottsdale's policy. They wouldn't have issued this policy to Central had it been required to do that. And it was not, because it was never asked for the umbrella policy to be primary non-contributory, only the CGL primary policy. Now, as I said, there is coverage. In fact, again, if you take a look at the Fireman's Fund policy, National Sureties policy, in the other insurance provision, you will find that they would agree with the insured to be able to drop down if the insured wanted that for an insured contract provision. So there are policies that would do it, but they took the premium for doing that as well.
Sure, I understand that. So I think you're using Mr. Edson's time. If you
thank you very much, Your Honors.
Thank you so much. Good morning, Mr. Edson.
Good morning, Your Honors. Your Honors, may it please the Court, my name is Eldon Edson. I'm counsel for Appley Scottsdale Insurance Company. While we've indicated in our briefs that we think this Court should forego plenary review and focus on the issues which were core to the District Court's decision, we wanted to provide a few extra comments in case the Court were to consider going beyond those things, issues ruled upon by the District Court. Ms. Pocaterra has spoken to the issue of the application of the cross-liability exclusion. It's set forth in our briefs. And as indicated, we contend that it bars any coverage obligation of the Scottsdale umbrella policy for this loss. However, additionally, the Scottsdale umbrella policy, it's important to note that this is true excess coverage, and it does not provide primary coverage for ISF. And Scottsdale contends, consistent with Indiana law, that the primary policy issued by Amerisure must exhaust prior to the time that the Scottsdale umbrella policy has any potential coverage obligation.
Is this your point about horizontal exhaustion? Because my question here is whether you can identify cases where that principle applies across parties. I certainly understand as to one party, if there's a layer of insurance, you exhaust that before you move on to umbrella or excess policies. But this isn't quite that situation.
Well, it's Your Honor raises a very good point. And there have been decisions which have looked at analogous situations. For example, the situation we have here where you have two insureds with an indemnity agreement between the insureds. You have a layer of primary coverage, then you have a layer of excess coverage over that. And there are many cases which look at the allocation where you just have primaries involved. And there are fewer cases, but still there are cases which look at this issue in the context of excess and primary coverage. And we'll concede that Indiana law does not have any cases directly on point which look directly at the situation that we're dealing with here or that I've been describing. But we have cited cases in our briefs. We've referenced the court to the decision of the Reliance versus General Starr case, which we feel represents the better reasoned approach to this allocation issue, and it's also consistent with the Indiana court's rulings with respect to horizontal exhaustion of primary coverage before excess coverage comes into play. Indiana courts have consistently...
But you are asking us to extend somehow what Indiana has done, even though we're not Indiana.
Actually, we're not asking for that because we think the court's decision is going to rest on application of the cross-liability exclusion. And I think, as I indicated, that rather than touch on issues that the district court did not touch on, it would probably be better to forego that sort of plenary review. However, if the court were to look at those issues, the court would be making determinations as to what the court thinks the Indiana state courts would do. That's correct, Your Honor.
I want to follow something. I should have asked you about this, but this is on the June letter, the June 24th letter. It's points out all the about the excess and the umbrella, and then it goes into section four, talks about other insurance, and then it goes to the exclusions, and the exclusion does not include whatever number this one is. Is it that your people just didn't know about it? Or do the implication is it's either one or the other. Either they knew about it and just didn't say anything, or they frankly just missed it, didn't realize that this was going to be an exclusion that would be later applied.
Your Honor, that's an excellent question. And I would note a few things in response. First off, Scottsdale, although it doesn't specifically reference the cross-liability exclusion in this letter, it does, in connection with that letter, reserve all rights under its policies. It also, in connection with the funding agreement, which was the source of this settlement, reserved all rights. And the parties agreed that they were going to maintain all rights under their policies, be able to express all the terms and conditions of their policies.
But you specifically excluded whatever, this insurance does not apply to bodily injury, et cetera, you know what's in there. So there is, other than everything else, they said we're not going to cover this. And yet this other one just seems to be the sleeping giant almost that dictates the result of this case.
Well, and Your Honor, there's another point here. With respect to the umbrella policy, both umbrella policies, those policies don't come into play until the primary insurance is exhausted. The primary coverage in this case didn't exhaust until such time as the parties entered into the funding agreement. And it was at that time that Scottsdale made it very clear, we're reserving all of our rights. If the appellants wanted to know further information with respect to each and every right we might intend to rely on, we would just say we're relying on everything in our policy. And everyone agreed in the funding agreement that that was sufficient.
So you plunged ahead thinking that this isn't going to go over $1 million and therefore we can handle it.
Well, at the time of the funding agreement, everyone understood that the settlement was going to be for in excess of $1 million.
You did? Okay.
Yeah. And that was how the case got resolved. Oh, I think I'm running over time here.
If Judge Mannion has further questions.
No, I guess I've asked the one I wanted to ask.
Thank you very much, Your Honors.
Very much. Now, did they have any? 2 minutes. Think fast.
Just a couple points. First, Ms. Pocketera talked about recent case law about the arising out of. Again, that's a Michigan Mutual case. I was Michigan Mutual's counsel. The very argument they're making here about what the causation test was raised in that and rejected by the Court of Appeals. It's the only court in Indiana that didn't apply that standard. But what the court said, it still required something more than mere incidental connection. And I will tell you, Your Honor, that test is raised. I raised it yesterday in the context of an environmental insurance claim under a CGL policy. It's litigated all the time. The cases that they cite are really not applicable because none of the languages of the cases they cite are the language from their policy. So under Tate versus Secura, it's not governing. As to horizontal exhaustion, we refer to Walmart and St. Paul, and we think the Indiana Court, the Indiana Supreme Court would follow those. Those are logical. Again, they, like a tennis player running behind their backhand, they always go back to California law. They rely on two California cases to oppose that. The Reliance case, the language is different because it carves out indemnity agreements from coverage. And the JPI case is subject to another exception to the general rule under the Niagara case, which is the Gerling and community redevelopment case discussed in our briefs and in our reply brief. And basically, the Scottsdale umbrella policy specifically designates that it's umbrella over the CGL policy and only the CGL policy, and that's an exception to the horizontal exclusion. And with that, unless the court has further questions.
I think not. Thank you very much. Thanks to all counsel. We'll take the case under advisement.